From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Pfizer is now the first company in the U.S. to seek FDA approval of its COVID-19 vaccine for use in people 16 and older. The Food and Drug Administration granted emergency use authorization in late December. Since then, Pfizer has distributed more than 170 million doses across the country. Its goal is 300 million by August.
Meanwhile, the U.S. supports lifting patent protections on COVID-19 vaccines with the goal of giving countries the ability to manufacture their own and expand supply in low-income and developing nations. But the vaccines developed by Pfizer and Moderna, which use mRNA, are highly complex, meaning it could be a huge risk to make them all over the world. And for more about how mRNA vaccines work, we're joined now by Dr. Drew Wiseman at the University of Pennsylvania, one of the researchers who pioneered the use of mRNA vaccines. Dr. Wiseman, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
You've been working with mRNA technology for decades, so you know that making vaccines in this way is not simple. One Pfizer executive actually said it requires 280 components from 86 suppliers in 19 countries. Is it going to take more than lifting the patent to expand access and supply?
So I've been working since really the spring of 2020 with the government of Thailand to build a GMP production site and help them make their own vaccine. So that's a local site that can produce RNA vaccines for that region. I think we need to do more of that. We need to set up similar sites in Africa, in South America, and in underserved areas. But the critical difficulty is the raw materials, both the enzymes to make RNA, the nucleotides, and most importantly, the lipids for the fat droplet that the RNA is held in.
Can you delve into that a little bit more, if you can explain in simple terms for our listeners how mRNA vaccines work compared to traditional vaccines that include part of the actual virus you're trying to fight in the vaccine?
So to start sort of at the beginning, when a cell wants to make a protein, what it does is it copies one of the codes in the DNA using mRNA, messenger RNA, that makes a copy of that protein code. It then travels to a machine that essentially reads the code and uses that to produce a protein. So what we've done with this mRNA vaccine is we're introducing the middleman. We're introducing the RNA that's taken up by immune cells, produces one component of the coronavirus called the spike protein. The response to the spike protein is what protects you from infection.
Why is this better equipped than traditional vaccines to fight variants of the coronavirus and even other viruses like flu strains?
The first thing is that RNA vaccines are incredibly fast to make. With RNA, you only need the sequence of the protein of interest. Once you've got the sequence, you can make an RNA within days to weeks. So it's very fast at responding to new pandemics, new emerging infections, and other potential diseases. The advantages of the RNA are also it produces protein for a couple of days, if not a little bit longer. The immune system recognizes that as more foreign, and it makes a much better immune response.
Well, doctor, I'm sure you're aware of the misconception out there that the mRNA vaccines are brand new. What can be done, do you think, to dispel that myth and ease people's concerns right now?
I think what people need to understand is this isn't a brand new vaccine. We've been working on this for 20 plus years, and many people have worked on this kind of vaccine. So it's well-established technology. It's been studied in people for over 5 years. What I like to point out to people is the risk-benefit. So the risk of getting COVID-19, people end up in the hospital at a rate of a couple percent for young people and 20-plus percent for old people. People die from COVID-19 on average 0.5% of the time. the COVID-19 vaccine is incredibly safe. So there's just no comparison of risk versus benefit for this vaccine.
That's Dr. Drew Wiseman of the University of Pennsylvania talking about the mRNA research that became the basis for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Dr. Wiseman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thousands of people in the U.S. have died in gun violence this year. That includes more than 175 people in Philadelphia. The city is on pace to set a single-year record for homicides after it nearly hit the grim milestone last year. Now, residents of Philadelphia are able to download a new mobile app designed by two friends who want to help communities prevent gun violence. WHYY's Aaron Wozell dug into how the app works. He has this report.
Mazie Kashir and Stephen Pickens grew up together in the 90s when Philadelphia routinely recorded more than 400 murders a year. They don't want to see that history repeat itself. Pickens says they decided to take action in October after learning about another fatal shooting in West Philly that left a young man dead. Pickens says he felt overcome with despair.
It was just basically pouring out at that time, like, we have to do something.
Enter the Philly Truce app, a new way for residents to anonymously share information about brewing neighborhood conflicts they think could boil over into gun violence. The hope is that intel can help trained mediators resolve those conflicts before they turn deadly. Kashir says the goal is to empower anyone to help with violence intervention in Philly by encouraging as many people as possible to download the app on their smartphones.
An app can modify behavior if it's properly implemented and marketed and advertised.
The app's home screen has two options. The Get Help button directs people to a form where they provide their cell phone number and describe the dispute. The Mediator button allows trained volunteers and professional violence interrupters to connect with residents who've reached out for help. Kashir says both sides remain anonymous at first.
All they'll see is Philly Truce is calling, you know. And then from there, those two people should start to cultivate a relationship. Okay, well, I can meet you tomorrow, or you want to meet at McDonald's, or, you know, and that's all it is, you know, with the ultimate goal of being the two principals or two of the people, the most influential people on each side saying, okay, let's figure out how we can bring this to a close.
Over the last couple months, a group of expert mediators have trained nearly 30 people on violence intervention techniques, including how to get warring parties to agree to a sit-down. Most of the participants are volunteers who are new at this. Others have years of professional experience. In most cases, an expert mediator will be called in to broker a truce once both sides have agreed to work things out with one of the app's junior mediators.
What I found in negotiating a truce in so many cases is half of the battle is the person isn't being heard.
Pastor Harrod Emanuel Clay is one of those experts. He's a longtime federal mediator and helped train the volunteers.
And we've also found that when they are heard, many times a lot of the anger and the frustration that's been pent up inside, they can get it out. So we earn their trust by listening. And the more we can earn their trust, the more they will allow us to help them mediate the situation.
Clay says the app has the potential to be a game changer.
This app is so significant that it could potentially take the gun out of the shooter's hand. Because the shooter doesn't need to shoot somebody if they can talk to a mediator.
I think that it could be extremely, valuable.
Akila Shirels is the executive director of the Community-Based Public Safety Collective, a national anti-violence organization. He says the app's success will largely depend on community buy-in and the credibility of the mediators behind the app. Shirels says the margin for error is exceedingly thin in the world of violence intervention. Mediators must respond quickly and show that they understand the people and the neighborhoods they've signed up to help. Without those things, he says the app's stock will plummet, especially in Black communities.
Black folks, man, we're going to give you one chance. This is a cultural dynamic that exists in the community. You know, they reach out to you, you don't show up, it's over. They reach out to you, the wrong person show up, it's over. Like, straight up. Because people have been let down, so much.
Sherrell says mediators must also be committed to going the distance.
You know, sometimes these mediation takes months, years, sometimes. Most of the mediations that we're engaged in, they require a lot of maintenance.
Mazie Kashir acknowledges the app's model may require some tweaking once it's out in the real world. Stephen Pickens says the ultimate goal is to help more people play an active role in stopping gun violence in Philly and to provide a way for residents to speak up without involving the police, who are often mistrusted in communities of color.
What the app does is it's giving the communities and the citizens of Philadelphia their voice back.
The pair is hosting events to shine a spotlight on the city's gun violence epidemic and spread the word about their new app. For Here and Now, I'm Aaron Mozell.
Around this time, 25 years ago, a new artist planted the seed for what would become a new genre. His name was Maxwell, and he sounded nothing like the heavily sampled hip-hop-inspired R&B that dominated the airwaves. A voice that harkened back to the days of Motown, Maxwell's silky smooth falsetto was accompanied by orchestra-level instrumentation, bass, violins, and something that up until that moment had been left behind in the 80s, the horn solo. Maxwell joined contemporaries like D'Angelo, Lauryn Hill, and Erykah Badu in introducing the world to neo-soul. Rolling Stone compared his album Urban Hang Suite to Marvin Gaye's 1978 album Hear My Dear, writing that his exploration of monogamy and matrimony was like a response to Gaye's exploration of divorce. The album is also known for restoring something else lost somewhere between the 80s and the 90s, deeply soulful music about Black people loving each other.
I remember having a journal. I always have a journal. And I said, you know, God, if you give me this opportunity, I promise to stay true to the creative, you know, thing that made me love Marvin Gaye, made me love Al Green.
Maxwell and I caught up with each other off the heels of his 25th anniversary performance for the NAACP Image Awards, and we got right into talking about the songs on the album that cemented his place as a neo-soul pioneer.
How are you, Tanya? How you doing?
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm good. I mean, I'm amazed. I'm elated. I'm surprised. I'm shocked. I can't believe this album. It wasn't like it was this thing that you heard on radio. We were all just beginning, and radio was really starting to understand that maybe this is a movement that they should get behind.
Nominated for a Grammy for Best Album, Urban Hang Suite starts and ends with two versions of the same instrumental. The first release was Till the Cops Come Knockin'. A song about police knocking on the door of a couple so enraptured, they stay holed up in their apartment for days. Blender magazine named it one of the greatest makeout songs of all time. Maxwell, folks can't see you, but I'm watching you. Every time we play your music, you like put your hands over your face. Are you still nervous when you hear yourself?
Yeah, you know, because it's almost like an alter ego, you know. And then when I think about the fact that I wrote that song when I was 20 years old, I mean, like, what did I know about that stuff? But I mean, you know, of course, time has taught me many things. But I'll just keep going from that part.
But wait, you wanted this to be your first single, and you made a big point to say this is the one. Why did you want this song to be your debut?
I mean, I think I just feel like the relationship that we have with the police is always being Black is the problem. And the fact that a song could talk about Black love being the reason why, you know, there's a disturbance that we need to kind of look into. What I see on TV or what I saw on TV with people who look like me were, we were either drug dealers, we were either unable to you know, have successful relationships. It was so important to be able to sort of express that aspect of who we are as people, the part of being Black that is Black love.
The second release, Ascension, marked a breakthrough for Maxwell into the Billboard Top 40 charts. But even with his success, Maxwell says he felt like an outsider, constantly trying to make sense of who he was in a world that largely sees things in black and white.
It's very interesting, you know, times have changed dramatically, but when you're, you know, a Brooklyn kid coming from a Caribbean background, having a Haitian mother, having a Puerto Rican father, you know, I would hear it all the time. People in the neighborhood like, oh, you know, you're the island guy.
That's where the mystique comes in. A star so reluctant, he chose not to have his face on the front cover of his first album.
I remember I would hear from people, like, I want to see how they're going to market this. The interesting thing about it is that I learned through the process of Urban Hang Suite and subsequent albums after, that the thick skin that I didn't think I had, it was there. It was more so there because the music was dictating the destiny that I was, I guess, supposed to get to eventually. And I think if you ask a lot of artists, like, you know, who have done music throughout their lives or whatever, I feel like the best records make themselves in some ways because of how much I love the tradition of soul music and what it means to the Black experience, to the civil rights movement. You know, songs like, you know, R.E.S.P.E.C.T. by Aretha Franklin, God rest her soul. I mean, these were songs that allowed people to get up and go out there and march. A Change Is Gonna Come, Sam Cooke. It's a tradition that has, like, given us an ability to sort of come together as people and even therapeutically get through the hard, harsh days of what it is to be Black in America.
Mm. Well, you're known for taking your time between albums, taking your time, I would guess, to reflect and be still. At least that's what I think. And in some ways, the whole world right now during this pandemic can relate to that need to be still. What do you think can be gained from pressing pause and getting quiet?
I personally like to have a life. So for me, making music is a slice of the pie, and all the things that you know, inspire the music, at least hopefully, those things are part of life lived that then I can apply to the songs.
Well, with that, it's been 6 years since your last album came out, Black Summer's Night. I know you hate it. Five, not six. I better get that right.
No, you know what? I'm always like, you know what I love about when people think it's a longer time? It means more to me that you think it's longer than it was, because...
No, I just can't count, obviously, Maxwell.
No, I just think that it's some, you know, I'll put it like this, right? If you care about something and you care about someone, if they're gone one day, that one day feels like a week. So if it feels longer between records, I take it in as like, wow, they really liked the last album so much that it feels like an eternity or something. I don't know. Or maybe it is an eternity. I don't know.
But with that, it's been 5 years since your last album came out. I know you probably hate this question, but what is next?
We're working. I mean, I have a chalkboard filled with at least, I don't know, I think maybe 50 songs or something. So we're just picking the right ones, putting them together, designing them, sequencing them.
What are the small moments you look forward to experiencing again and performing in front of live crowds again?
I can tell you this, the awards are amazing. You know, I'm cool with, you know, being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't mind that.
Yeah, you're not going to say no to that, but yes.
You know, I'm not mad at the Grammys. I'm not mad at the, you know, the whatever awards that are out there. But I am so grateful to the real lives that have been touched. I hear stories about people playing this woman's work when they're having their child, people playing Lifetime when they've lost a loved one. I'm literally near tears as I'm expressing this to you. These are the true awards. This is what really it is. This is why this is the stuff that I will be able to take to heaven with me. This is what I look forward to when the world opens up and we can burn up and we can go out and get on the beach and go to shows and do those things. And I'm a little rusty right now, and I'm gonna rehearse like probably for like a year because I just really want to be on point, because I know that anybody who goes to a show is going to expect nothing less than absolute best from not only me, but from anybody who steps on that stage. So to all the people who survived the pandemic, to all the people who lost people during the pandemic, to all the people who lost people because of the civil unrest that we're experiencing around the world, you know, my heart goes out to you. I hope that when we get to a place where we can all connect again, that we can give you the show that can get us to the next part of this new decade.
Well, Maxwell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Grammy Award-winning musician Maxwell talking about the 25th anniversary of Urban Hang Suite. And hey, Maxwell and I talked music for almost an hour about the changing industry, the comparisons to another neo-soul great, D'Angelo, and how the late DMX made him feel seen. You can hear all of that on a special podcast of our conversation on the Here and Now feed, wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, it seems like everybody's got a bone to pick with the news. So what happens when somebody stops talking smack and just decides to wage all-out war?
First thing you do in an invasion, you eliminate the communications of the enemy.
And what happens if they win? Visit Stockton, California, for a story about a revolt against the mainstream media that's shaken up a city. From NPR's Invisibilia.
It's been another terrible week in India. The country set another record for new COVID-19 infections today, more than 414,000, and there are nearly 4,000 more deaths. The BBC's Amir Pirzada joins us now. He is on Skype. Hello, Amir.
Hi, hello.
The numbers are so staggering. Hospitals are overcrowded, so much so that they're turning the sick away. Could you describe what's happening in this crisis now?
I think the COVID crisis is India. It's getting worse with every single day, as it is now spreading across the rural areas. That's where it's going to get more scary, because in rural India, the health infrastructure is not that great, like if we compare it to Delhi or any part. So things are worse, things are grim, and the situation is absolutely alarming right now.
Yeah, it was less than 5 months ago, in fact, that Prime Minister Narendra Modi was telling leaders at the World Economic Forum in Davos his country has this excellent infrastructure and COVID preparedness, so things would not get out of control there. As you say, that may be true in some of the major cities, but not in the vast number of rural areas. So what are they doing to try to bring help to those areas?
Right now, this government is under a lot of pressure, but what this government managed to do is to shift the blame to state governments, saying that the decision making lies on state governments. If they want to impose a lockdown, they can do it. And I think the time is lost. They have lost their time to control things and to say that they have done something, because in health infrastructure wise, oxygen supply wise, increasing number of beds, getting more ICU beds in place, getting ventilators, oxygen concentrators, they have lost that one whole year between first wave and second wave.
So at this point, the official daily death count has been over 3,000 for the past 10 days. And this is something that has international implications as well, and that's known very much and spoken to by Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor. he actually said in an interview regarding India that a complete shutdown might be needed for 2 to 4 weeks to help ease the surge of infections. Is that anything that the country is considering? As you said, that states are being allowed to make their own rules, but is there any impetus to have that done on a national level?
Honestly, nationally, it seems that there is no government which is taking any decisions, because we don't see any concrete decision coming from Narendra Modi's government. Everyone has been calling the current government that we need to have a nationwide lockdown. But Narendra Modi's government, I think what they failed in was to have a national lockdown well in advance, when this was about to break out, when about to emerge as a big bomb for India.
Is there any sign at all of hope in the country right now?
I think that's what every Indian is looking for. That's hope. But in reality, which is a brutal reality, right now we don't see that coming from anywhere. Although the top Indian courts are intervening and asking federal government to supply oxygen. Medical students have been asked to help doctors in treating COVID patients. All this is happening, but people are still dying.
Thank you. I'm sorry we have to end it there. We will be following the story closely in the future. The BBC's Amir Pirzada in Kashmir. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
New Jersey is gearing up to be the first state in the nation to incorporate a climate change curriculum across all 7 subject areas, of course for science, but also physical ed, social studies, and performing arts. As more states consider how to teach about the impacts of climate change, we wanted to check in on Chatham High School in Chatham, New Jersey, one of more than 2,000 public schools in the state implementing its new curriculum this fall. Kristen Crawford is the supervisor of science at Chatham High, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Well, Kristen, New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy made this interesting point when she said, "The generation that you teach is not only the most impacted by climate change, but will also be in charge of finding solutions." So this infusion of climate change curriculum that you all are doing, it's pretty expansive. It's meant to be taught across all subjects. How exactly will this work?
So that's a great question. So we at Chatham High School and in Chatham Schools, we are implementing climate change sort of across the K through 12 curriculum. So at the high school level, we talk about climate change not only in the sciences, but we are also discussing it in classes like our English classes, where we might be reading a book that has to do with climate change. Another great example is in one of our world language classes in our German class. Students have done research about how other countries are dealing with climate change and some of the solutions that they are using to mitigate the impacts of climate change. We also have architectural classes where students are using green practices to be able to design different buildings so that it's kind of infused in all these different areas.
What's been some of the most challenging parts of building this ambitious curriculum and teaching this topic?
So I think one of the things is, first of all, we know that our science teachers have a great background on climate change, but really discussing sort of what climate change is. I always say that when you talk about climate and climate change, a kindergartner is not going to understand what that is, but they can understand how to dress the bear for the weather. So one of the things that we might do at a kindergarten level is just talk about what is climate and how is climate kind of, you know, related to weather. And then building on top of that, how climate is kind of changing and what happens when climate changes. Why should I be really concerned about climate changing throughout my lifetime? We want students to know that as a young generation, first give them knowledge about what it means and what climate change means, and then empower them to be able to design the solutions that they can in order to change climate change or slow it down, and to maybe even change some of their family practices.
This is all going to kick off beginning in the fall.
which, you know, of course, us being in a pandemic right now, we're hoping that all of students will be back in school by then. But what are some of the challenges for your district right now as you all are preparing for this really ambitious effort?
So I think some of the, you know, challenges that we have right now are students, you know, their hybrid model or being in school for part of the day. But we're incorporating hands-on things with, you know, considering social distancing and disinfecting. So the teachers are really going above and beyond to give students those hands-on experiences and those skills. Only because, you know, we know that if we are designing a green building or if we are designing something that's a model of alternative energy, it takes hands-on. I think computers are great and they have a place, but we also want them to be able to experience, maybe sometimes this doesn't work out. How am I going to problem solve this and make it work? But I think that the teachers are resilient and they really find great ways to be able to get the ideas across to students.
Well, let's bring in one of your students, high school senior Naomi Boyd. Naomi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So you're currently taking AP Environmental Science. You're also a member of your school's green team. Last year, you attended several town hall meetings to discuss the ban of plastics at grocery stores. I mean, Naomi, you could be focused on a lot of things at this age. Why is this topic so important to you?
Well, I grew up in kind of a woodsy area of Chatham, and I've always really appreciated all of nature. And I think climate change is kind of stressful for all of that wildlife. And I really think that we need to keep it nice and green and beautiful. Like, I mean, the world has always been like this, and seeing the changes that are happening because of humans is kind of alarming.
Yeah, you can see it right before your eyes.
Definitely.
We've seen Greta Thunberg and other climate activists address the climate crisis in Congress. What do you want the conversation in Congress to be about at this stage?
So I think Congress should address the energy situation that we have right now, because so much of our energy comes from fossil fuels, which are maybe the largest contributing factor of climate change, because they're contributing directly to the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So I think the ultimate goal should be to have those electric vehicles be powered by renewable energy like solar or wind.
You heard me mention to Mrs. Crawford, New Jersey First Lady Murphy's statements that your generation is the most impacted and also the generation that will likely find the solutions to this crisis. Is that daunting? Does that feel daunting to you?
It does a little bit, but I think it's kind of a welcome challenge, because I think so many people in our generation are really interested in this issue and they're really willing to work to solve it. And I think we will definitely come up with a solution very soon at the pace we're going.
Kristen, how does it feel to hear students like Naomi be so knowledgeable about what's happening in our world? And not only that, she's an activist.
So, you know, for me, it makes me so proud to be able to have a student who has been, you know, gone through our high school, taken our courses, to be able to be informed. And really, that is our goal as educators, to be able to teach the students about issues that refer to climate, and so they understand the climate science. It's not really about a political activism in a sense. It's that, you know, we want you to understand climate science because maybe one day you'll be the one to create the solution, but understand climate science so you can make an informed decision and improve your quality of life in your community, maybe globally, and then maybe perhaps, you know, become an activist at the political level. So I'm, you know, Naomi is a great example of someone who's gotten the knowledge through many of her courses, but I also feel that we are doing a good job at setting the seed to students as they're young and as they move up, and they'll get to understand it a little bit higher as they go. So hopefully we'll have more students to be able to, you know, make the change, so to speak.
Do you have any tips for teachers or other schools outside of your state who are just taking on this step?
You know, for teachers, I think we don't want to overwhelm students. We want to empower students. So we want to say, yes, this is a problem, but guess what? This is how we can solve it. And, you know, I think that it's that balance between the two, because I find that sometimes students are not really aware of the different types of green energy we have until we introduce them in the classroom. But then they'll notice it more if they're driving down the highway or going on a trip and seeing, you know, a wind turbine or solar panels. And they'll go, oh, yes, we've learned about that. And this is how they work. So I think don't get overwhelmed. Take it step by step. And I think that with anything that we do, teachers do, we educate kids for the future, and you're educating students to just, you know, make the place where they live to be better.
Very good advice. Naomi, I'm hearing that you're graduating in a few weeks. Congratulations. Tell me what's next for
you. Thank you. I'm going to be studying at University of Massachusetts Amherst in the Honors College, and I'm planning on majoring in biology and hopefully studying animals and ecology. I was really interested in looking at patterns of birds and how that is changing because of climate change.
That's high school senior Naomi Boyd and Kristen Crawford, who is the supervisor of science at Chatham High School in New Jersey. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And my best to you, Mrs. Crawford, as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Four former Minneapolis police officers face new charges today for their role in the arrest and death of George Floyd. A federal grand jury has indicted the men for violating Floyd's civil rights. Derek Chauvin was among the officers charged. He was convicted last month on state charges of murder and manslaughter in Floyd's death. The new indictment says Chauvin's fellow officers failed to intervene when Chauvin held his knee to Floyd's neck during an arrest last year, even after Floyd became unresponsive. It accuses them of acting with deliberate indifference to Floyd's medical needs. A separate indictment charges Chauvin with the arrest of a 14-year-old boy back in 2017. He used a neck restraint then as well. We will continue to follow this story. Let's go to Arizona now and the ongoing and controversial election audit in Maricopa County. The U.S. Department of Justice is the latest agency to raise concerns about it. The Republican-controlled state Senate has hired a private company to conduct a hand recount of more than 2 million ballots from the 2020 presidential election. Let's bring in Andrew Oxford, a reporter for the Arizona Republic. Andrew, welcome back.
Hey, good to talk with you.
So let's lay out this fact. Officials in Maricopa County have already conducted multiple audits that have shown the results of the election were indeed accurate. So this recount appears unnecessary. It's run by one party, the GOP-led Senate. It hired a private company to conduct it. What's going on?
You know, the Civil Rights Division raised a couple of concerns. One is that your federal law has requirements for state and local election officials to care for records of a federal election. Maricopa County's ballots are now in the custody of the state Senate, like you said, and it's hired private contractors to handle the ballots. So lawyers for the federal government said they're concerned the ballots are no longer under the control of election officials and may not be adequately safeguarded to make sure they're not damaged or lost. They've been moved into the Veterans Memorial Coliseum here, which is a basketball arena. Early on, especially, there were questions about, you know, people just being able to wander into the facility and the place not really being secure. The department also took issue with plans beyond the recount, which you mentioned. You know, the part of what the Senate plans to do is for its contractors to canvass certain neighborhoods, knock on doors, and ask if certain people voted. The Civil Rights Division raised concerns that this could violate laws against voter intimidation and said such efforts, it's seen in the past, often target people of color. The Senate's contractors have been pretty tight-lipped about this process. They say they won't ask how people voted and are looking at areas where they think there was anomalous voting history. But I asked the CEO of Cyber Ninjas, that's the Florida-based company the Senate has hired to oversee this whole process, how they decided which neighborhoods to enter. He said it was based on a statistical analysis, but he didn't make it, and he wouldn't say who did make it.
So it's not just the Justice Department. The Secretary of State in Arizona, who is a Democrat, is also challenging the recount. And I wonder what the Republican leadership in the Senate is saying in response.
You know, the Senate leadership has been working on a response to the Department of Justice and to the Secretary of State, but Cyber Ninjas has certainly rejected criticisms of the process. They say the ballots have been secure from the start, and they put out a statement last night attacking the Secretary of State, saying that, you know, she was trying to turn this into a political or partisan process. So it's really turned into a back and forth at this point.
This is really confounding, though, because there is no official standing to the recount. It won't change Arizona's vote totals, and certainly not the national election results. So why are Republicans in the Senate conducting the recount, which is presumably costing a lot in state treasure?
There are a number of Republican legislators here in Arizona who, you know, say that they're convinced, even if proof hasn't turned up, that there was some sort of wrongdoing in the last election. There were a number who wanted to throw out the results altogether. And this process is really an outgrowth of that. But you mentioned state funding. You know, the Senate's contract for this process is only $150,000. This process is going to cost a lot more than that. We haven't gotten a final total, but there have been a number of private groups, a lot of them associated with, you know, officials from the Trump administration, that have been actively fundraising on this. These are groups that aren't going to be required to say where they got this money or exactly how it's being spent. But this also, you know, this has turned into a big kind of fundraising opportunity for supporters of the former president here.
And one more thing, the recount has to be done pretty quickly because the Senate has to get out of the Coliseum.
Yeah, the Coliseum was already booked when they moved into it. It's May and there are high school graduations coming up. It seems almost like a comically parochial issue to come up. But May 14th is a pretty hard deadline to get out of there because then after that, you're going to have people with caps and gowns and everything else. So where they're going to be able to continue this, if they're able to continue this, we really haven't heard a clear plan. The process has been moving pretty slowly. As of yesterday, there were only about 210,000 ballots counted out of 2 million. So we're not close.
Andrew Oxford, reporter for the Arizona Republic. Thanks a lot for speaking with us again.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.